Why is learning as a leader a bit like going to the gym? How does a self-confessed introvert and data-driven scientist rewire themselves to make high-stakes decisions with incomplete information? And what does it really mean to lead a biotech as an outsider, an immigrant, a woman, an introvert who never set out to be a CEO? Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. Today, I'm joined by Olav Lodek, CEO of Constructive Bio based in Cambridge, UK. Constructive Bio is a biotechnology company specializing in the manufacturing and design of proteins and peptides with new chemistries for pharma and other industries. We'll talk more about the science at the end of the episode. Ola, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
You did your master's in your native Poland before coming to the UK for your PhD, and you worked as a scientist with Isomerize Therapeutics and Cambridge Glycoscience before joining Reflection Therapeutics as chief operating officer. And now you're leading Constructive Bio in your first time CEO role. But let's go back to the start real quick. How did you get into biology and biotech in the first place?
So I really want to take a step back and start from thinking what were the headlines when I was growing up, because my memory reaches into early 90s, and I grew up in a very, very interesting times from biotechnology perspective. So yes, as you said, I grew up in Poland, and even as a kid flipping the newspapers or watching evening news, the biotechnology was absolutely impossible to ignore. I remember TV reporting on the first successful trials in severe combined immunodeficiency, which was the first gene therapy. Then there was a HIV crisis and a situation where biotechnology-derived treatments changed the death sentence into a manageable therapy over just a few years. I remember also mad cow disease and a situation where daily newspapers were reporting about PRPC and PRPSC. In everyday headlines. And then there was a dolly, which was cloned, and it was the first cloned mammal. But what was also very interesting, we started asking, where does the science end and where something else begins when we play with life?
Because I don't think a lot of people talk about these things at the dinner table, except the mad cow. Obviously, that is a very big topic at the dinner table when you're eating lamb burgers for the first time and wondering what's going on.
For me, definitely, it was a recurring topic at home. You know, like we talked about genome sequencing at home and what does it mean and what will it bring? And, you know, now I'm living 3 kilometers away from Sanger Genome Campus, and I'm living in not only DNA read era, but in a DNA write era. And yeah, it definitely was something that has been on my mind since I was a little kid. And I actively remember that.
So it sounds like you had that exposure to those conversations. Definitely very science-minded parents. How did they influence your journey towards leadership?
My parents were quite intellectual. My mom went to med school. My dad went to law school, but has written his master's thesis about blood typing and paternity decisions, right? So they all had some sort of interest in things related to biology. But my parents were very pragmatic. They came from mining towns in both cases. Mm. They had a very traditional outlook on what is the good job versus bad job. The good job, when you're good at sciences, is going to med school and becoming a doctor. And I was a very good student. I went to med school. I did not enjoy it at all. I really did not enjoy the job experience after the first year, which was on the ward. And I decided strongly that I need to make a move and do something else. And this is what opened my biotechnology studies. So I transferred to biotechnology. I finished a first degree in biotechnology, which at that time in Poland was 5 years in the lab, doing lots of research, but also having an individual selection of the curriculum at the level, which I think was fantastic. So I was the master of my own destiny. I was choosing the courses I was taking. I was diving really deep into the biochemistry, molecular biology, and biophysics. And I definitely discovered that I like knowing more about the underlying principles of life than being the helper of people. And definitely the decision not to stay in med school was a very right for me at the time. And I think I'm very grateful that my parents were supportive of me transferring to a different degree and starting from scratch and going a completely off-piste direction. I ended up as the first scientist in my family. I've ended up as a first person with a PhD in my family. And it was definitely a defining moment to move on from that reasonable life choice of a career of being a doctor, something that my parents really understood and supported, to a very exotic career in biotechnology, which, there are not that many biotechnology firms in Poland. So I'm not blaming my parents for not understanding that this was on the table. I don't even know whether it seriously was on the table at that time, to be fair, but I finished a great degree. It gave me an opportunity to go further and study my PhD in biological sciences in Cambridge. Yeah. And it all ended up very well for me. So I'm very glad I took a detour that convinced me that I am more of a scientist than a medic, definitely.
And so you made your way to Cambridge. Tell me, what was that leadership journey for you like? Because you were a researcher for a few years, and I think you mentioned you were headhunted for your current role.
I like to sometimes joke that I never considered being a CEO until it was in the recruiter's pack that landed on my desk. And I started talking about the technology, and what has driven me to this position was not a call to lead, but a call to do this particular technology with this particular founder in this particular setting. And I like to think that for years, I was absolutely driven and fascinated by that field. But what I will be doing never had a name tag on it. And that name is Constructive Bio for me. I am not sure if I would like to be a CEO of any other organization. The future might tell us the answer to that. But for me, that call to lead was really related to the technology. And it was a natural transition for me in any sense. I am a very introverted person. I'm very wired to go really deep into questions. I like going through data. I like modeling data. I like answering deep questions and coming up with the only true result of an analysis. This is where I feel grounded and safe and happy. So obviously, that's not how leadership looks like, right? That's not how the CEO role looks like. We are operating in a vacuum. We don't know what's going on, and we have to make decisions often on insufficient data, and we don't have time to have enough data to back up every single decision. But I also, long time before I started at Constructive Bio, I somehow subconsciously started to prepare myself. I've read countless leadership books. I completed executive MBA at Warwick Business School. I listened to countless podcasts, and I've always tried to make myself better. But also reflecting on that transition, I had a very unfair advantage coming from my husband's unwavering support. So, he is a very smart person with very good financial skills. So I was allowed to take bonkers risks. I was able to take bonkers risks. And considering that I was also willing to take those risks, it all have fallen into place. And I was able to make some unusual career steps that led me into that leadership role at Constructive Bio. But I would say I had to go through a journey with my self-development to lead me where I am at the moment, definitely.
So it sounds like you didn't quite know that you were going to be a leader, but in some way that was, you were walking that path.
So I think, just like my parents, I'm a very pragmatic person, right? So if I'm working on a project and the project is going well, by nature, the project grows and you need to communicate the project better, right? If you need resources, you need to communicate clearly. You need to make right decisions to justify the project's longevity. So I've tried to strengthen some of the skills that perhaps weren't natural, or maybe sometimes they are sold as natural soft skills that some people do and some people don't. because I was trying to be effective. And that drive for effectiveness was coming from pragmatism, which told me that I need to educate myself and get better. I'm a very keen weightlifter, and it reminds me that I have some gym talents, some particular muscle strengths. I have some muscle weaknesses, and it doesn't give me a mandate not to work on my weaknesses. I have to do a full body workout in order to progress. And I think this is very similar to how we work as leaders in biotech, that it's commendable to build on your strengths, but also polish your weaknesses in the right way.
Before we kind of get into the big tech conversation and why you chose to lead Constructive Bio, again, this is your first time as a CEO, and obviously this role really spoke to you. What was an early challenge that you overcame as you began your CEO journey?
So I want to talk about two challenges, if that's okay with you. First one is I was very self-conscious, and I was asking myself constantly whether I needed to become someone else to do this job properly. And I've mentioned that I'm an introvert, and, you know, I've never been a person that walks into a room and immediately works it. So, for example, networking events are not my natural habitat. And I'll be honest, I'm also quite impatient. So I don't fit the bill for what I thought a CEO should be. And straight after the recruitment process, Jason made a joke about it being me versus five other middle-aged men called Tim, you know, as a counterparts of the recruitment process. But we do think about CEOs in particular patterns, and we have some particular expectations of this super calm, tall man who already achieved everything. And, you know, I was asking myself, am I wrong for this, right? And by nature, I'm really quite hands-on. I want to know exactly what's going on. In old school management critiques, I would be probably called micromanager, even though I don't think I'm a micromanager, but I just know that sometimes I need to intervene. And I know that the more I know about the technology at the company, it's the better for me and the investors and the outcomes. But first challenge I had to overcome is understanding that I'm actually fine. I'm okay as I am. I need to grow. I need to make myself better. But leadership isn't fundamentally about this loud charisma or, you know, being the loudest and the least busy person in the room. Leadership to me is about relentless focus on the mission and the value we are bringing. So it is about caring more about the outcome than about the optics. And if you get to the outcomes, everyone will tell you that the optics have always been irrelevant, right? We're living in the era when I have an access to some biographies or autobiographies of some amazing CEOs from tech industry and beyond. And I was reading a lot of them, trying to find my path and then probably thinking about whom I need to become to be better and change myself fundamentally. And I finally found out that my approach is not a liability. And I think today, if you ask my investors or my employees, they will probably tell you that it's an advantage that I am very scientifically driven. I'm very skilled at what I'm doing, and I have a good grasp on what we are doing exactly as a company this moment. I had to start to trust myself as a CEO, and it did not come naturally to me. Learning to back my natural instincts of how I could run the organizations, as opposed to what people say is optimal, was a challenge. I think there was a second thing I had to overcome as a leader of Constructive Bio, and that is an outcome of being an outsider, of being an immigrant, of being that a person who doesn't fit the expected bill for the CEO pattern that we expect. Don't get me wrong. I never tried to use this as an excuse for not doing well. But I sometimes think that when I moved in 2009 into UK, I had no idea what I walked into. And I'm still occasionally quite bamboozled. So the cultural shock was huge. And leading a company in UK was a challenge. And let me dive into this a little bit, if that's okay.
I'd love to hear something to exemplify this, because I've been an immigrant myself. I've got a few stories from Finland, but yeah, I'm not going to get into them.
I do believe that every person should be transplanted to a different country for a short time to learn what diversity really means. And it's not about, you know, the visible diversity. It's about the different ways people communicate. I laughed to my husband recently that all my move to UK and being a CEO of a UK company felt to me like waking up, I'm at Bridgerton's Promenade and I don't know the rules, right? So it is a huge cultural shock. I'm going to refer to a very interesting intellectual framework from Hofstede's work. It's about cultural dimensions. It's not only academic, it's a framework I use in communication with my colleagues. I use it in communication with my managers and so on. Poland scores really high in comparison to UK on uncertainty avoidance and high on power distance. And I talked a moment ago about distributed decision making, which sounds egalitarian, but it's not really if you think about that it dives into accountability, right? So everyone, regardless of whether they are a research technician or the chief operating officer, should know what their role is in the Polish brain of a CEO, right? UK is very different. I sometimes tell someone that they should know what they need to do. And it's much less obvious for a Brit or an American than it is for a Polish or Chinese person. And I do think that the indirectness dressed up as politeness in the UK and consensus dressed up as performance is something that I don't naturally align with. And it caused me lots of trouble over the years. But I also think that goes both ways, right? So when I arrive into a room, I think I cause some deep suspicions from the UK-centric audience. You know, I'm still a relatively young CEO in comparison to the average one in the industry. I have a strong Eastern European accent. I'm rather blonde. I'm not from the right university network, even though I did my PhD in Cambridge. Everyone asks you where you did your undergrad, right? I wasn't from the right postcodes, didn't have a right last name. So I think I always felt that when I'm entering a room, there is a certain calculation happening when I arrive. And the answers the audience is arriving at was that I don't particularly fit. So I felt like an outsider. I think it was being compounded by being a woman as well. And I want to name it, there is a central amount of misogyny in this industry still. And it's never like a stupid, overt misogyny. It's a very elegant and quiet misogyny. It's about like who is asked for their opinion and who is not asked for their opinion, rather than someone being sent to fetch coffee, right? I sometimes say things and they land nowhere. And then there is a man who restates what I've just said 5 minutes later, and they are applauded for a very good insight. But those challenges are real. It's a challenge of being immigrant, challenge of being a woman, and challenge of being a non-canonical CEO to an extent. But I think we can turn those into strengths. And I'm very excited about what I'm building. This is my favorite job to date. And I'm absolutely in love with Constructive and what we are doing and the company we are building.
You've touched on something that's, I think, very poignant, because we've just had International Women's Day on Sunday. So my follow-up question to everything you've just said, because I can't understand it as a male and as a non-CEO as well, I want to know, how do you call that out? And how should men in the room, especially in like the boardroom, how should men respond to it?
I would welcome if people just said, hey, so-and-so just said that. Right. But I've seen it happening only a few times. I think Jason, our founder and the CSO, he is really good at redirecting a discussion to the source of the information that happened first in, for example, board discussions. So I feel super supported by him on that level. So how can we call it out? I think it's about when we deal with individuals contributing something amazing, we have to really champion those individuals. But how I've read it is that it applies to both genders and everyone around the table, that we need to actively participate in championing women if we want the numbers to flip. But I also want to create an environment when people make a choice, right? Not everyone has to be C-level. Not everyone has to be a manager. Not everyone should aspire to be a paper pusher. I just want people to have a choice in where they want to thrive and how they want to build value. Mm-hmm. I'm a big advocate for women in the workplace, for financial women's rights. I've mentioned earlier that the reason why I was able to become a CEO of this startup, right, was that I was able to make a choice. I was financially in a position where I could take risks, and that is rare. I want to be as ambitious as possible, but of course, the reality also kicks in, and it's a reality of who is allowed to make choices and in what context. And again, I want to be clear on that. I personally don't have kids, so it's much easier for me to work long hours, to work weekends, to travel wherever I want. And there's basically very little responsibility I have in life outside of my work. So that's it's quite a masculine position, talking stereotypically about, like, it is my unfair advantage in comparison to a lot of really talented, hardworking women around me. But I think I want to be scored on the basis of my track record. I think this is the most important thing, and I'm optimistic about the future.
Well, we're talking about your track record and as well, women who have successfully raised huge amounts of money. You have raised 15 million seed round, was it 58 million Series A? Which a transatlantic raised money. Really quickly, I want to ask, is there anything that you have learned from a peer or a colleague that you could not have learned from your MBA or any schooling?
Yes, I went through a number of accelerators. I went through an executive MBA. I've completed far too many degrees. And I really like formal learning through a degree or course environment, because it always allowed me to focus on what I'm doing and carve out time into self-development in organized fashion. But no one really talked to me about intentionality in the way that Jason did. And Jason really taught me to think so much deeper about why we are doing something. Not the what, not the how, but the why, which is the core theme in intentionality. And I've just mentioned about the formal organized training. And I think it's quite ironic because when I go into a course, I switch off all the distractions. I focus on the course, and intentionally, I build my knowledge and I self-develop myself over restricted amount of time with the intention of achieving X, right? So I always practice that, but I haven't thought about this. At the accelerators, at the university, you're sometimes told to focus. But I think if you only focus without the intentionality, you lose the perspective and you lose the ambition of what you are trying to do. So with intentionality, when I'm building Constructive Bio, I'm not raising capital for next 2 years of runway. I'm not raising capital for milestone X, even though this is very important. I am raising capital because I want to build, a new Genentech, a sustainable, large European company that is going to introduce proteins and peptides with non-canonical amino acid across many different pharma partners and then across many different industries. So everything has to fall into place if we are intentional. And if we are intentional, we don't waste our energy on things that don't matter in the long term. with focus only, you still can use all your energy on something relatively small that then happens to be a blind alley of your journey. But asking yourself what you're using your energy on, understood as intentionality, is a big secret I've learned from Jason. I'm nowhere near where he is, because I always thought that the more I do, the better will be the outcome. But I always wanted to be the hardest working person, right? And I also am a bit of a people pleaser. This is something I'm trying to fix as I grow as a CEO. But, you know, I want everyone to be happy and cohesive and the focus around me. So my journey of intentionality is rooted with what Jason was always saying. And I'm trying to implement it in the way we manage our employees, the way we manage our projects, the way we raise the venture capital, the way we choose which projects are worth pursuing. And I think people should think a lot about intentionality, and that will also fuel our ambition for the long term.
I think you've touched on a few things there that kind of lead me nicely to the final question I want to ask. As a leader, you have chosen to address this relatively, like, incredibly unique challenge that you are looking at non-canonical peptide proteins that you can make in cells. And this is where you've mentioned pharma, you've mentioned the application potential other industries. And I know, coming from industrial biotechnology background originally, that there's so much scope for what you could do with this. So tell me why you have chosen this challenge as a leader and what it means for patients, for other stakeholders, for society at large, and why you chose to pursue it.
We are living in the era of peptides, and everyone in pharma knows it. And if you go on Reddit, you will also know that everyone believes that we are living in the era of peptides. But it's very difficult to produce those molecules chemically. They are made at the moment through a technology called solid phase synthesis, which for every 1 kilogram of active pharmaceutical ingredient produces 13,000 kilograms of chlorinated solvent. And I don't know about you, but I think it's nasty that we have some fantastic drug that can change someone's life, but there is a burden of reproductive health, aquatic health, environmental health, planetary health related to this. And it reminds me of the Industrial Revolution, when we were, you know, producing a lot of steel, but also destroying all the environment around us. And I want to make that dent through changing the standard of peptide manufacturing. I want this to be made with biology. Biology is fantastic. It's energy efficient. It's green. It doesn't produce chlorinated solvents. It self-propagates. So you start a tank with a single bacterium, and in a glimpse, you have a 10,000-liter fermenter of cheap biomass relying on very inexpensive sources of nitrogen and carbon. I think this is all very commendable, but it's precisely what we can do today as a company. And this is how we are talking to our partners. We enabling them to make peptides in a much cheaper, much more scalable, much more reasonable way, rooted in synthetic genomics and engineered translation. But also, there's a step two, which is, because peptide manufacturing is such a pain, not only because of the waste I've just mentioned, but also because it's near impossible to chemically synthesize peptides over 50 residues. So we can open the gates of heaven of new peptides designs in the right way. And I just want to wrap it up with taking a step back and thinking about where we currently are as mankind, right? We can design in silico those really amazing peptides with new to nature features. We can then design the strains with AI that have objective industrial functions implemented deep into the genome. And we can marry that peptide design and strain design and create the green cellular biofactories of the future. And this is what the technology of the company I'm building is providing. And I just find it incredibly rewarding that we can make a dent on human health, planetary health, and economics of biomanufacturing at the same time. So I'm building something pretty special, and this triad of biomanufacturing, new molecules of the future, and new strains that span engineer translation, synthetic genomics, meet in the middle to make really amazing molecules. I find it very fascinating.
Yeah, I love your analogy of the Industrial Revolution. It seems that whenever humanity hits this technological advance, there is societal benefit and an unforeseen consequence, and that you're addressing this as well as introducing this technological change is exemplary. But the next follow-up question to that is, what can we do in the ecosystem? And by we, I mean not just your team and your scientists, but investors broadly, pharma companies, regulators, other industries, as this may apply to. What can we do as this biotech ecosystem to help realize this future?
To realize this future, we have to focus not on doing less and restricting, but doing more in the right way, right? So you've mentioned the Industrial Revolution analogy. If we banned people from producing steel or producing steam engines, we might have a slightly better environment around us, but we will be still living a much more primitive society. And I want regulators to be very science-driven and ask themselves, is the peptide A still a peptide A, regardless of how we make it? And if it is, let's go, right? I want investors to understand that it's not about a fashion of what we call platform versus, what we don't call platform, and, oh, I don't invest in platforms versus all sorts of trends and observations that go cyclically. Like, I would like people to be driven by the science, driven by the track records. I want others in the environment to collaborate. And this is something, again, that touches on that focus versus intentionality. It's okay to be at two early stage startups and work together. It's not always risk stacking. Sometimes it's unlocking synergy. And I would like people, once again, to be more intentional, more ambitious, and really committed to everyone's success. And I think this is the last thing I want to say. I'm a cheerleader towards all the other CEOs in the sector. I want to help them as much as I can, because I believe that if public market investors get their heart back into biotechnology, we all will be more successful as the ecosystem, and there will be more jobs, more technology, more progress, more drugs going to patients, and more what we've started from, more amazing products that transform lives. So I would like people to think about the long game and be more collaborative, if that's the one magic thing I could change in the ecosystem.
And finally, I have one more question, as I often do. We've covered a wide range of topics, but is there anything that we haven't covered that you would like to talk about on the topic of leadership to end your podcast?
There is one more thing that no one prepared me for when I became the CEO in the first place, is what is sometimes called the CEO loneliness, which is a topic that people every now and then talk about. I love a book by Ben Horowitz, which is The Hard Things About Hard Things. I think it's a book that describes a CEO life best out of all the CEO books. All the CEO books are written in a way that it looks like some sort of consultant has written about how they think that CEO life should look like. And there's a few really good exceptions. One of them is that Ben Horowitz book. But I think that the loneliness of the CEO I'm facing, particularly materializing itself around my interaction with the board and the emotional burden of the CEO board interactions, this is something that I believe only other CEOs can understand. And I am very grateful for the fact that I have access to the peer network where I can openly talk about this. This is not something you can discuss with any employee. This is not something you can discuss with your investors. This is not something you can discuss with your board. I guess you can discuss it with an executive coach, but my experience is that only another CEO understands the CEO. And I think you have to bring a real confidence into your every board meeting. And it's not a fake confidence, because it has to be something that you arrived at from your work and through your work. That's something that you have to have in you in order to build that conviction that what you're doing is right, and then you can intentionally take it to the next level. But I don't think anyone in the world understands other than your peers. So I would say that even when you're introvert like me, even if you are happy with reading books and looking at wildlife outside, which is something I absolutely adore, getting that hands-on experience-led advice from your peers is incredibly, incredibly important. So yeah, I appreciate what LifeScience.org brings to the table. I think there is an element where we are positively geographically spread in that peer group. So it doesn't always feel like a competition for the same airtime, same panel airtime, or it feels like a group where we all invested into each other's success. It feels more natural. And I know a few people around here, but it kind of feels more natural to talk to people who I don't perhaps meet every day, and every now and then we can focus on something related to leadership that is important. Yeah, I don't want to sound like I'm, moping around my big problems of boohoo, I'm so poor that I have to interact with my board. But you have to bring your best game constantly into the CEO life. And it feels a little bit like being a performance athlete or performing artist, where you cannot really have time off. So people are talking a lot about work-life balance and balancing your life around what you do, outside. I work a lot. It is taxing. And while I absolutely love it and I'm very proud of the outcomes of my work, it is a very lonely job that I'm very grateful that I have some access to the peers to learn from.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time today, Ola. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much. It was really fun to talk to you, Dave. And I really love you to listen to your podcast as well.
Thank you. It's no secret that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions inspire us every week. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our life science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.